Welcome, Raul. Can you briefly introduce yourself, say a little bit about what you study and what year you are?
Hi, I'm Rahul Jain. I'm a third-year graduate student in the Department of Physics and Astronomy at MSU. I'm doing research in the field of experimental nuclear astrophysics, where I study nuclear reactions that are happening in the crust of accreting neutron stars.
Can you explain what a crust of a neutron star is? I don't know what that is, considering like stars are gas.
Neutron stars are basically compact remnants of like massive stars. When they die in a supernova explosion, and what remains behind is a neutron star. And so a neutron star is basically a very compact object. It's very dense. Like one spoonful of matter would weigh like tons of pounds. And
Wow.
you can imagine like the mass comparable to the mass of our sun is basically crammed into the space, like in a space like the size of the city of Lansing. So it's very, very dense. And but it's not homogeneous. It has like a structure similar to that of our Earth. So it has an atmosphere, it has an ocean, and then it has a solid crust where like the nuclei are basically arranged in a lattice structure. So that solid crust is basically where you have a lot of neutron-rich nuclei, and there's interesting reactions happening there. And so we study those reactions in the laboratory.
Oh, very cool. So how do you actually like study, how do you like study like a neutron star? Like, if it's far away, do you, I just don't even know where to begin. It's like, how do you even just pick a star and then how do you observe it? Like, how does that kind of go about?
So there are multiple ways of studying neutron stars, direct as well as indirect. So the only direct measurements would come from astronomy, where we look at neutron stars through our telescopes. We can view the X-rays coming out of them, the ultraviolet rays, the radio waves. I mean, all sorts of like in the whole spectrum. More indirect studies happen in sense of like modeling and stuff, where we basically sort of have a basic idea, depending on the physics that we know, what those neutron stars should look like, and we predict what should we see in our telescopes. And then there goes the feedback study between each other, where astronomers see something that the theory modelers try to explain, or theory modelers can model something strange, which astronomers try to go and work out if that exists in the universe. And so these are the two basic ways in which you study neutron stars. Now, for modeling these neutron stars, what you need is a whole lot of data. So data on nuclei, data on all the other physics that goes into it. So one part of that physics is nuclear physics, where you have to understand the cross sections. I mean, the probability of nuclear reactions happening. The properties of nuclei, like what are their spins, what are the parities, how much energy is released through the nuclear reactions, so the Q values and stuff, the masses. And so the experimental nuclear astrophysics comes in, where we actually measure these properties for the exotic nuclei in the laboratory, and we provide those as an input to theoretical modeling. So it's like a bridge between astronomy and nuclear physics, where we are trying to use nuclear physics to explain astronomy.
Well, that's super interesting. So it's like it's almost like you're studying like a star in person, like there, like indirectly. But that's super cool. So what got you interested in like doing this kind of nuclear astrophysics route? Did you, yeah, how does this come about in your studies?
I mean, surprisingly, nuclear astrophysics is is something that I didn't ever imagine myself doing. I mean, in fact, when I came to MSU, I had never even taken any astrophysics course. I had zero background in astronomy, but it was something, and it looked interesting. There was like available position, and I sort of like wanted to try something, and so I tried it, and I just like loved it. It was a steep curve, like a learning curve in the beginning, but I'm so glad I took that position, and here I am.
Yeah, that's super cool. I remember I talked to Allison, and she, it kind of sounded like she was in a similar boat of like never took an astronomy class or anything prior, and then went into doing nuclear astrophysics. That's really cool. Have you taken like additional, have you taken since then, you know, astronomy classes kind of getting like that realm, or are you still kind of more in like the nuclear side of things and it just happens to be in space?
No, I mean, I actually enjoy astrophysics aspect equally. And so I have taken courses on nuclear astrophysics. In fact, I also took a course on stellar astrophysics that was like kind of optional, but I really liked the syllabus. Then I also attended a summer school on experimental nuclear astrophysics. And so all this training kind of helped me really understand the fundamental field. So initially I thought like nuclear astrophysics would be very much nuclear physics with just application part, but it's actually an interdisciplinary field where the field sort of the field itself dictates on what questions nuclear physics should ask, and so it's actually a field on its own with a very rich like kind of history.
Oh, super cool! That's super cool. Okay, so I'm just going to kind of go back when you did your undergrad, was it in physics?
Yes. So I am originally from India. I should have mentioned that before. So I did my college at the Indian Institute of Technology, Roorkee, which was a 5-year program. So I graduated directly after master's, right after high school.
Oh, okay.
And so, yeah. And after that, I moved to the US to start my PhD.
Oh, okay. What kind of got you interested in physics to begin with?
So when I was in high school, I had a cousin who was studying physics, and she used to explain all these interesting concepts like relativity and stuff to me, and quantum physics, wave particle duality, which got me super interested in the kind of physics, like what physics has to offer. And I remember reading the story of King Midas, who basically whatever he touches turns to gold. And so nuclear physics actually sort as a naive student trying to explore stuff, I thought nuclear physics would be the only option to sort of turn that fiction into reality, where you could do like real life alchemy and basically change nuclei, change atoms, turn them from iron to gold or whatever. So that was like my that's what inspired me to basically study nuclear physics and dwell further into this topic.
Oh, very cool. Did you, when you were like in this undergrad master's type program, did you do research during that time? Well, in addition to classes?
Yes, I did explore a lot of areas of physics during my undergrad as research internships and over multiple summers. So my very first internship was in the field of fiber optics, basically. So studying the nonlinear phenomena. It was a computational project. Then I did one internship at CERN in Geneva, where I studied, I explored like the high energy physics side. Turns out that I wanted to try something else. And so I did an internship in Australia in the nuclear reactions group there. And by that time, I was pretty sure, like comparing sort of the experiences that I had, that nuclear physics would give me the perfect balance between sort of like doing cool stuff plus having access to the cool stuff. Like high energy physics is cool too, but your access to the actual cool stuff is sort of like limited. And so nuclear physics seems like the perfect balance for me. And when I was in Australia, I did I got to participate in experiments where I got to get my hands dirty and like work on things like hands-on, which was very satisfying. And so hence I decided to go ahead with nuclear physics.
Oh, very cool. Yeah, that's because otherwise I often think, at least a lot of, especially with the particle physics and all that, it seems like it's just a lot of programming in front of a computer screen. But that's really cool that you actually got to do something with your hands.
Yeah.
Yeah, super cool. So just kind of curious about So what was your first internship again? What was that?
Yes, it was in the field of nonlinear optics, where you try to basically model the solutions of waves traveling through the fiber optics in the form of solitons.
Okay. Is that like your kind of like first sort of like research, you know, I'm actually in a lab doing something?
Yes, that was my very first research experience that I actually got through a program organized by the Indian Academy of Sciences. And it was sort of the very first thing. I mean, I had just learned how to program stuff and mm-hmm. that too in Fortran. And so a computational project was kind of a challenging thing, which I seem to enjoy. I've always been fond of like logical reasoning and stuff like those things, and programming seemed like a very natural extension.
Yeah, I was just kind of wondering like how like your confidence, you know, kind of differed from like your early internships or your latter internships. Because I know like the first time like I did like some sort of research thing, it was like, oh, it was very intimidating because I'm like, I don't feel like I know anything. And, you know, I was had just learned programming, so like I wasn't that experienced with it. Did you feel like you gained more confidence as you kind of done more and more different things?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I was I was pretty intimidated during my first experience. Like, I was like going in, I was very motivated that I would do awesome things. But then I realized that it's like you have to have a base to kind of start with. And then most of my time was spent redoing the calculations that were already done before. But in that process, I was still learning and gaining skills. So, I mean, I didn't like find anything new or as such, but I still learned a lot in that. I mean, in fact, I liked the computational aspect so much that I went on to get a minor in computer science and engineering. And I guess it was somewhere the contribution of that research internship where I sort of like made this choice that this is something that I like and I would like to pursue.
Okay. And so did you feel like it was a very supportive environment to, you know, people are willing to help you along, or was it like, oh, okay, I'm doing this thing, I'm just kind of by myself and I'm just self-teaching?
It was like people were supportive. There were like postdocs in the group, and the professor that I used to meet like weekly, sometimes twice a week. And whenever I was stuck on things, which I was because I had a very little background in programming. So people would always keep like ask me how I'm doing and sort of like keep me on track. This internship was also a part of like a fellowship program. So I had to submit reports of the work that I did to basically sort of successfully complete the program. And so I basically had a deliverable, which kind of made it like a more serious thing rather than just playing around. So yeah, I mean, there were checks to ensure that I actually learned something and documented it in a way that I could like tell people like how what I did.
Yeah, I actually did something that was useful or contributed in some way.
Yeah, or even like I learned something that I can talk about, like just in that sense.
Yeah. So then how do you end up at MSU? Is it because, like, I know MSU has like, you know, a very good nuclear physics program. Is that what led you here?
Yeah. So, I mean, after finishing my, undergraduate while I was like in the last year or so, I was pretty sure that I wanted to do nuclear physics. And so I applied to a bunch of schools, in the US as well as around the world. So I wanted to come like to the US for the reason that PhDs here are typically longer. That would give me more time to sort of explore stuff even within nuclear physics. There's nuclear structures, nuclear reactions, nuclear astrophysics, as you know. So that was one thing. And then because like I could still like take classes and I could explore stuff while taking classes before committing myself to a research project, that was sort of the idea. And then I applied to, within the US, I applied to 4 or 5 different schools, and I got into most of them except one. In fact, MSU was like the last school I got accepted into. And so before that, I was pretty set on going to the University of Notre Dame because that was the second choice that I had. MSU was my dream school for obvious reasons because of the great nuclear physics program. And so, but I didn't hear from MSU until then. And I did all my visa formalities and stuff already set to go to the to Notre Dame. And I just heard from MSU. And within a couple of weeks, everything changed. I had to do like all the formalities again. And I was then at MSU. So,
okay.
Yeah.
Well, that's cool that it ended up working out. And that's also kind of like funny that you say like, oh, PhDs take longer. And that was your reason. I feel like I often hear people like, oh, the PhD is just so long. But that's like a really good like philosophy that you have. Like, oh, yeah, I got to try different things.
Yeah, I mean, so starting graduate school, I was like still not very confident about like things I know. And so one thing that I was scared about is if I would do like a PhD in Europe somewhere, say in 3 years, and work on like single project and get out with a PhD, which I could do because I already had a master's in undergraduate thing. But I was scared that I would somehow not be able to have like a broad picture of things and that I would still be lacking somewhere. So that's why I wanted some time. And instead of taking a break, I thought I would just get into school right away and sort of take that break in the program itself.
Yeah. And I saw in the thing that you sent me that you're doing a dual PhD in CMSC.
Yes. So, I mean, as you, so I've always been like interested in computer science and computing since then. And MSU offered this a very nice thing of the option of doing a dual PhD with the CMSC department. That's the Department of Computational Maths, Science, and Engineering. So the thing is, the deal is you have to take a few more subject exams. Like it's not exactly 200%, but it's like 120% of extra work. You have to basically your thesis, you can just write single thesis, but it should have incorporate elements from both the disciplines. Mm-hmm. And you basically graduate with a dual PhD. And that was something I was like really interested in. So, yeah.
Yeah, it sounds like the stuff you're doing, it seems like it would overlap quite substantially a lot of what you're doing.
Yeah, it does.
Yeah, very cool. Well, I saw when you sent me this note, I was immediately interested, but I purposely didn't do extra research because I wanted to learn it from you. But you mentioned you were like an almost professional squash player.
Yeah.
And so I want to learn more about that. When can you explain a little bit of like what squash is? It's like in my mind, I can't think like racquetball. Similar.
Yes, it's similar to racquetball played within a box, you can say, hitting balls on the wall. It's an international version of racquetball, or you can say racquetball is a US version of squash.
Okay. So how long have you played that, or do you still play it?
Yes, I started playing squash in high school as an amateur, but when I went to college, I got like really into it. There was a coach and a proper team there, and within like a couple of years, I got into the college team, and I then spent a summer at the Indian Squash Academy, where I actually got to play with the professional players, and that's how I kind of then also got onto the state team for my home state and once played the national squash championships. And so I say an almost professional player because I have not been in that area since I came to the US. So although I do play squash here, but not at any of the level there that I used to play before.
That's super cool. So is squash, you say you play for your school. Is it, like a top level, like sport, that like people attend? Like, I just don't know that much about it.
Yeah, it's the equivalent of varsity sports that the US has.
Okay.
So, yeah.
Super cool. Do you play? Do you? Is it singles, doubles? You know, could be either.
Yeah, it could be either, but doubles squash is not very popular because you are like in a single room. In a single room and with four players, it becomes really complicated. So they have like separate. They have a separate courts that are slightly wider to accommodate four people, but it gets riskier because there's chances of running into the opponents. And so I basically just play the singles version of the game, which is kind of more standard.
Oh, that's super cool. So how is that kind of experience? So you're doing this while you're doing classes. So I imagine like both, like if you're going to be like that good, that you probably had to put a lot of time into it. Like how is, you know, keeping up with, you know, classes and, you know, doing, you know, participating in sports, you know, time management and all that.
Yeah, the best part, I mean, I would like kind of thanks to the college that I was in. I mean, I used to live in college dorms, I lived there throughout my college and we had like excellent sports facilities right on campus. There was a coach there and my classes also were on campus. So, everything was like right there. So I could attend classes during the day and play squash in the evening. And because I was on the college team, I also got a little bit extra, like proper nutrition, proper training and stuff like that. So it's all because of that, I guess.
Super cool. Super cool. Wow. Awesome. Were you ever a part of like other clubs or like organizations or anything like that while you're in school or like had interest outside of physics?
Yeah, I was a part of the audio section at IIT Roorkee. That's my college. And so the audio section, basically, there were a bunch of like music enthusiasts. So not music and such, but like, there were electrical engineers and stuff. They used to handle the audio system for any kind of functions that happened on campus. So we had our own, the club had its own speakers, mixers and stuff. And they used to basically host like DJ nights or a radio. We also had like a radio channel for a while and just give like sound systems for any events that happen in campus. So I was a part of that as well.
Oh, so cool.
And we used to like hang out together.
Was there anything that like led you specifically to that group?
It was just during my first year, different student organizations had their pitches, joined their groups, and I just happened to be like, it was just coincidence.
Very nice. Yeah, that sounds super nice because then it's like you have. Me, I'm always a big promoter, like you should try to get involved with things that are outside, you know, like your little tiny bubble. That seems like a fun way to, you know, meet people, even if they're like engineers, you know, different setting, you know, of like, hey, this is a non-academic realm per se. Yeah.
Another thing towards the end of my college, I was also part of the students mentorship program. Wherein people senior students would mentor like either freshmen or sophomores depending on their need in particular disciplines and help them get into research or help them with classes if they are struggling so it was like a one-on-one mentorship program similar to what we have here at the
Wild. Was that through the physics department? Was that a physics mentoring?
It was an institute program, but they had a separate sub program for each department. So I was a part of the physics department stuff in the institute mentoring program.
Oh, okay. And then that sounds very similar as to what you said about the mentoring program at WAMPS, which you happen to be the mentoring, you know, co-chair of that. I'm assuming that's not a coincidence.
So mentoring has always been a key thing in my career as well. And this is something I really want to promote forward.
So in your mind, like, what are the key parts that you say, like, are like the keys do's and don'ts as a mentor? Like, what should a mentoring relationship sort of look like in your mind?
Mentoring relation should be driven by both parties. Like, both should be equally interested. And I believe that it's basically give and take. So both parties should equally benefit from this relationship. It's not about just mentor guiding the mentee and mentee getting the most out of it. Even as a mentor, I have learned things that I would not have otherwise. So how to be like, basically, it's like just the soft skills or the people skills, as we call it, how to guide someone, how to be patient, how to be empathetic, like listening to problems. So all those skills, it should be like a two-way street. And I mean, more than that, you basically develop sort of a relationship with a person and you just expand your network. That's how I view mentoring as. Okay. I mean, there are formal roles for mentors and mentees in a way that, a mentee will have like more questions and would seek advice from a mentor, but the benefit has to be like both ways.
Very nice. So what would you say, and maybe you don't know this, but like, so when you finish this PhD, like what are your plans? Do you want to go into like a education research kind of role, put more emphasis on mentoring, or have that be like a sidestep as like part of your other future goals?
Yeah. So, I mean, career wise, I want to stay in research in academia as long as possible because I enjoy doing research, and mentoring is basically the core thing in academia. So, because the structure is such that you are like graduate student, you're a postdoc, you're a professor or a research scientist, and you always have people that you work with or like juniors that you basically train or something. And so in academia, the structure is such that mentoring is already an integral part of it, and it can be more formalized depending on the needs.
Okay, very cool. So then I'll just kind of ask, like, how was your transition, you know, like coming into grad school here? Was that transition relatively smooth, or, you know, was there a steep learning? Well, you already mentioned like a steep learning curve with like the astrophysics learning stuff, but is the whole transitioning from undergrad, master's to PhD relatively okay?
It was very smooth. I mean, partly because there are excellent resources available at MSU, being a big school like MSU, and especially the physics department and the NSCL, like, takes really good care of students, and like they strive to make sure that students are progressing, and they want their students to succeed. And so in that sense, I got like all the support that I could ask for. I was basically allowed to exempt classes because I had already done graduate level coursework elsewhere. But to take the subject exams, I wanted to repeat some of the classes, so I was allowed to do that. When I was like TAing, I asked for a different role in my TAing, and that was like granted by the graduate program director then. And so, yeah, everything has been pretty good. I was like doing research before, and so that adjustment was also good. There were some cultural adjustments that needed to be done. I mean, I hadn't really lived before anywhere that snowed, and so I had seen snow before but never really lived before, so that was a change. Then
now we have plenty of snow.
Yeah, but fun. I mean, it would, a lot of people are surprised by the fact that I actually like the snow, and I prefer cold weather anytime to the hot and the humid climate that we have here in India.
Mm. Are you in India right now?
Yes, I was traveling for a few weeks in the middle of the semester.
Okay, very cool. Very nice. Is that to be with family?
Yeah, just visiting family, yeah.
Yeah, very nice, very nice. Do you have any, like, tips or suggestions for for, say, like undergrads thinking about grad school, you know, what to look for when looking for a school, or they get accepted, you know, can't adjusting to the change of pace?
Yeah, I mean, I would say that always look for like research opportunities that you have. And so, I mean, and like look for the people that you're going to be working with. So when I went for grad school visits, I actually made sure to talk to lots and lots of grad students, also current grad students in the group that I was intending to work with, work in. So that was really a plus, really knowing the culture and making sure that it will be a good fit for you. And one thing, there's always this question between a big school and a small school. Like everything, I mean, both of them have their own pros and cons, and you just have to work with like what works for you. And so having this clear thought, I mean, you can never be 100% sure of what you want, but just sort of having a clear vision of like what you would want and what is something that you definitely don't want.
Very nice. When you came here, did you have a set like advisor in mind already, or is it more like, oh, I can't want to do something in this subfield?
Yeah, it was more like I wanted to do something in nuclear physics and explore different things. But yeah, I started working with my current advisor, Professor Hendrik Schardt, the day I arrived at MSU, and I've been in that group since. So.
Fantastic. That's great. Glad to hear that. Yeah, that's super, super great. Can you?
And one thing.
Okay. Yes.
So yeah, one thing that I wanted to add in the previous questions of like transition to MSU. So one thing as an international student that I did was participate in the International Friendship Program by the OISS office. And so it's a program where international students are paired with local members in the community, and you get to do stuff like things with them to sort of like introduce you to the community. And it's a chance for them to basically interact with international students that come to MSU. So I was paired with Larry Lee, who is an MSU alumni, a retired journalist who lives in Lansing. And with him, I was able to explore most of the American stuff. We got to like, we celebrate festivals together. I got to visit his family in Thanksgiving on a farm in northern Michigan. He took me sailing on his boat in Lake Michigan. So doing those sort of experiences actually got me more like a home feeling at Michigan. So I consider Michigan my home now.
Oh, that's super cool. What was the name of this organization again?
It's the Office for International Students and Scholars, OISS, at MSU.
Awesome. I did not know about that, but that sounds super great. Okay, so that's like an MSU related program. Do you know?
Yeah.
So okay, do you know that like other universities? When did you learn about this? Was this after you had shown up, or like before you had arrived?
No. So after arriving to MSU, within a couple of months, there was an email by the OISS asking you to come to an event where they would discuss, like give out information about this program, which I attended because there was free pizza at that event. Mm-hmm. And so that program sounded really cool. I signed up for it, and there was this process of like interviewing people and matching people. And it was about a month or so, and I was finally paired with Larry.
Oh, that is awesome. I will definitely promote that now. That's super cool that they do that. So you had mentioned like, oh, you had done stuff, you know, like going out boating. Like what kind of like activities and, you know, adventures have you gone on through this?
Oh, through this, yeah. We went to cross-country skiing. We went to like Henry Ford Museum. We went on a trip to Upper Peninsula together, the UP, going to, yeah, Pictured Rocks National Lakeshore, the Quammen Falls. Yeah, all sorts of stuff. We haven't been on a trip out of state yet, but we plan on doing that too in the future.
In the future, when it's safe.
Yeah.
Super. Oh, that is awesome. Oh, great. I'll be sure to link that into the episode. Yeah. Well, thank you for coming on and talking. It was a pleasure talking with you.
Yeah, it was great. Thank you so much for having me.